You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. There were over 28,000 reported cases of domestic abuse in Wisconsin in 2012, the latest data available. 71% of those incidences included an arrest.
Our next guest says that while many people might consider domestic violence to be mainly a personal issue, it's actually also a political issue. She says policies can be put into place to help protect victims of domestic violence.
Kathleen Arnold joins us now. She's a professor of political science at DePaul University. She's been researching issues of poverty, race, and gender for more than 15 years. Her latest book is called Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? The Politics of Domestic Abuse. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, why do you say that domestic abuse is a political problem?
I mean, one way to make a comparison is kind of like saying with racism, for example, you could experience interpersonal sort of racist incidents, but there's a larger threat out there or a larger kind of power matrix of racism that you can kind of map that personal interaction onto. And I think we should do the same with domestic violence. We shouldn't see it merely as personal or private, but something that's systematic that affects a great number of women. And for which a lot of perhaps shelters, police, and policymakers could perhaps do a better job on.
What do you think happens when, as a society, we see domestic abuse as a personal thing between two partners instead of as a broader issue in society?
Honestly, I think we make a lot of mistakes. And one of the things I think about quite a lot is some of the stories of my friends who have thought they could report domestic abuse and were surprised to find out that they were arrested, for example, and not the people who assaulted, you know, their partners who assaulted them.
Ray, let's talk about that. I mean, for one thing, you list in your piece, you talk about the story of Ray Rice, I think he was the NFL player who was caught on camera attacking his wife. And I didn't know this, but they were both arrested apparently after that.
Right, and dual arrest is actually the kind of go-to policy in about 23 states, although there's a movement to arrest the primary aggressor, so it's like called the primary aggressor, like kind of noting that dual arrest has not had the effect it's supposed to have. But can you imagine being Janelle Rice, having all of America watch that happen, and then knowing she was arrested?
What is the policy behind that practice of dual arrest?
I think I've heard a couple of things or seen it, you know, through my research. And one is that the police don't really want to get involved, that it's up to a judge to sort it out, for example. Another thing is like a sort of misguided gender equality that I have to say I'm absolutely fascinated with. When we make a situation equal that's not equal, that the woman must have done something, this kind of two to tango mentality.
So sort of it takes two to cause trouble, takes two to fight. Is that what's sort of underpinning the philosophy there?
One would think, and then a third philosophy I've heard, although it's more, you know, academic, I think, is that it actually protects the woman. But you have the arrest on your record. If you're an immigrant, you could be put into deportation proceedings because of this. So it's a pretty serious thing to have happen. It's also traumatic to be arrested after you were attacked.
So how would it protect the woman just in that she's separated from the person she was being abused by?
That's one argument I've heard. I don't know how prevalent it is. I think it's more the gender equality and the police not wanting to, you know, they don't want to be psychologists. They don't want to sort out who's to blame. And a lot of domestic abuse isn't as injurious. It's not as clearly as injurious as we would like. So you don't just look at people and know who the guilty party is.
So you were talking about an egalitarian attitude toward male and female relationships. Let's talk a little bit more about that. So that seems as though that's at the crux a lot of the policy that you're taking issue with right now. How does that, besides the arrest, how does that play out in how domestic abuse is handled, both at the time of the incident and afterwards?
I found a sort of egalitarian attitude, and it's, you know, in research, it's called the symmetry argument, this idea that probably both parties were in conflict and one side might have been, you know, more injurious, but that they're both sort of to blame. And I found that it was pervasive in some psychological approaches, you know, to handling abuse, to, you know, the dual arrests. It's problematic. I called the title of my book is Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? It's this idea like, oh, if you just tell him how it's making you feel, that'll make it better. It's this idea that you could communicate your way out of the situation. So we refuse to see that it's asymmetrical, that there are different power relationships, even within a relationship that appears to be equal, that I think are pervasive in some shelters, in counseling, in policy, and yes, in arrest. But the other part is that what I found is mothers who are attacked are often disproportionately punished. And I guess I could use punished in scare quotes.
Mothers who are. And why would that be?
Right. Well, so some states have adopted what's called failure to protect laws. And these laws are this idea that if you are attacked, assaulted by your partner in front of your children, including even one time you didn't know the attack was coming, that you could be held accountable as a mother for being attacked because you failed to protect your children from that abuse, or you exposed your children to abuse. They witnessed it. And the range of punishments, which might not clearly be punishment in, you know, the legal sense, but what I call punishment, is you could be separated from your children under investigation by child welfare, up to like the Tondalo Hall case, if you guys have heard of it, where this woman faces what seems to be a hefty sentence, close to a life sentence, for being abused by her boyfriend and her children were attacked, whereas the boyfriend got 2 years.
So what is at the crux of that sentence? Is that she failed in the eyes of the law to protect the children?
Right. And so it's kind of perverse. Like, I think part of the problem is treating relationships as if they're equal, you know, even though we know that there's still unequal political power, unequal economic power, and so on and so forth. But then focusing on the mother as the sort of responsible party, right? She should have left. She should have done something else. And so she becomes the person that the law targets.
We're talking to political scientist Kathleen Arnold right now. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and Katie says that domestic violence is a political issue and not a personal issue. And so you've been outlining some of the issues that you see with the way that domestic violence is handled in this country. What would you like to see change?
Well, one of the things I argue is that the way that we treat refugees, and I do need to qualify this in a second, but the measures we use to determine abuse in other countries that constitutes a human rights abuse is actually a really interesting set of criteria that we could apply to our own country to understand ourselves better. And so there are two really classic cases. They're classic and yet very recent. One is a case from Mexico and the other case is from Guatemala. And in both cases, it's Department of Homeland Security that oversees, you know, matters of immigration and, you know, refugee policy. They've developed a really interesting way to determine that domestic abuse in these two areas is political. It doesn't mean it didn't happen personally and in the home, but that it's political in several different ways. And I find it ironic that we can see sexism and inequality in these countries and give haven, you know, like we give refuge to these women. And yet we can't do the same thing on our own soil. Instead, the mother could get arrested.
So would that be a matter of different agencies in federal and local governments maybe talking to each other and creating a coherent policy? Or what do you think is the holdup?
Honestly, I think that for some reason we think today that if you're in the United States, you're free, so you're free to enter a relationship. No one's holding a gun to your head to get married or just live with someone. And so we assume that women have much more freedom here, I think, than people, for example, women in Guatemala or women in certain parts of Mexico, to leave their partners. But the Department of Homeland Security doesn't just look at what the government does or doesn't do. They look at societal beliefs. You know, is there a link between sex and violence? Do we think that some violence or coercion in a relationship is actually part of love? And I think if we looked at our own country, it wouldn't just be the policies. It would be, you know, what's on TV. What kind of message do we give people? Do we actually think abuse is sort of normal? And we don't even call it abuse.
So do you think it's fair to say that the societal interpretation of domestic violence in the United States and the situation specifically that women here are facing is equivalent to some of the other countries that you're referencing there, Guatemala and Mexico, that there is a direct equivalency between the two?
No, I'm not saying the outcomes are the same. What I'm saying is if we applied the same test, so we have a sort of test when you say, okay, you're from Guatemala and you're saying you need to find refuge in the United States. Did you call the police? Do societal beliefs actually, you know, reward abusers? And so I'm saying let's use the same measures. We'll have different outcomes because we can get divorced more easily, perhaps, in the United States. But at the same time, I don't think women in Guatemala are being jailed for exposing their children to abuse. I don't think they're losing their children because they were abused. So I think we'll find a different picture, but one that's no less sexist and troubling. And even, you know, you got to think, what does this mean about women? What does this mean about our ideas of motherhood? And what does it mean if African Americans and other racial minorities are disproportionately targeted, you know, when this sort of thing happens in the United States?
We're talking to author and political scientist Kathleen Arnold now, talking about her argument that domestic violence is a political issue and not just a personal issue.
We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What policies would you like to see change to help protect victims of domestic abuse, to help prevent domestic violence? Have you experienced the situation or maybe something in your family? How was that treated by shelters, by authorities? Or have you been someone working at a shelter, or have you been a social worker or law enforcement officer dealing with the domestic violence in this situation? What do we get right? What do we get wrong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation now about how domestic violence is a political issue and not just a personal one. Kathleen Arnold is our guest. She's a professor of political science at DePaul University and the author of Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? The Politics of Domestic Abuse.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know experienced domestic violence? How was that situation treated by a shelter or by law enforcement officers? What policies do you think might have helped? What needs to change to prevent domestic abuse in our policies or in our culture? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, we go to our callers now. We have Cindy joining us first in La Crosse. Cindy, hi.
Hi. My personal experience was that because I did not have proof of the verbal and psychological abuse and different controls that my ex was using on me, my only recourse was to seek divorce and drop my complaints, otherwise risk losing custody of my child, which I was obviously unwilling to do.
So did you choose to do that? You dropped your complaints, Cindy?
I had to. It was that or lose my child.
Cindy, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience with us. And Katie, what strikes you as you hear Cindy's story?
I think, you know, a couple of things. One is that we think of domestic abuse as just being hitting or just being an assault. And there's a lot of control that goes on. Evan Stark has this great book or a great theory on coercive control, and he's written quite a lot about it. It's really helpful, I think, if your callers want something really good to read. Abuse never happens really in a vacuum, or the sort of abuse that I'm interested in, but it's asymmetrical, that's unequal. And so we have to recognize that there are signs of, you know, escalation of inequality that can limit people, that can undermine their parenting, their economic possibilities. So I feel really sympathetic to the sorts of control that, you know, she feels like she went through.
Cindy, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate that. And Katie, how did shifting the responsibility to press charges from the victim to the district attorney, how did that change things for domestic abuse victims?
You mean in Wisconsin, or?
I believe that's something that you had said, yes.
Shifting responsibility.
So who presses the charges when it comes to domestic abuse?
I mean, it can happen in a range of ways, right? Like, I could go to the police and say that I'm being abused, or there are certain areas in the United States in which district attorneys could take over because they feel that victims are too afraid, for example. From what I know, that doesn't always work just because the other host of sort of like nonprofits and kind of societal beliefs don't really support putting someone behind bars because they assaulted a woman, for example. So I don't think that's going to be the cure-all.
So it hasn't changed enough, in your opinion, when that is the practice?
I would think that's a small change, and it's not misguided or bad. I understand it, but I don't think it's going to change everything, no, when you have such an egregious or such disproportionate blame on women. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, we're going to go back to our callers now. We've got Jana with us in Milwaukee. Jana, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, what is your story?
I was listening to what you guys were saying, and actually fairly recently I was thinking about a situation in my family regarding domestic violence. When I was a child, a family member of mine was involved in a domestic violence situation that ultimately led to his girlfriend's death, and he was in prison for that. So growing up, you know, my family tried to help me see the good in this man and that, you know, you aren't just one action. And ultimately, I ended up myself in a very abusive relationship as a teenager. So it was just kind of an interesting, you know, looking back on it all, it was an interesting position to be in because I see now that I spent a lot of my time trying to find the good in my boyfriend at the time who was, you know, emotionally and physically abusive towards me.
Jana, sorry, you dropped out a little bit there. I think we lost you, but I think she was getting at some of the family dynamics there and how that can inform, I guess, how we think about things later on. It sounds like she wanted to have a good impression of an earlier family member and then was maybe herself, it sounds like she thought, a little too forgiving later on or accommodating. How complicated is this dynamic when you're talking about families and about these intimate relationships with sort of getting a handle on what's happening?
I think it's important, but I think one of the parts of my book is it's not enough, that we can't think of families, especially who have these sorts of issues that are being replicated, as being self-sustaining. And I don't think that means that people should come in and boss families around or tell them how to live. I don't think that's democratic. But I don't think when people ignore their neighbors or they ignore the abuse that's going on that they think that it's not their problem. I think as a society, we should feel more obligations to help or say, how can I help you? I think another thing that she was talking about is our society doesn't necessarily take emotional abuse seriously. And I've been thinking about the way that we often ignore PTSD, for example, and how that can kind of influence dynamics in a family. And it's not until violence occurs, including homicide, that people kind of think, oh, I should have recognized that abuse is occurring. But we've had all these signs. We want to compartmentalize between, you know, oh, it's just emotional. You can suck it up, or you can read a book, or you can, you know, you can leave. But very often one, you know, is embedded in the other. Violent acts occur, you know, after emotional abuse or during.
Now, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. What do you want victims and families and support networks to know about things to be aware of and ways to support people who may be affected?
I think one of the things is we really have to think about the degree to which we end up either making a situation equal because we want to be democratic when it's really not equal. And that doesn't mean every single interpersonal conflict doesn't have some, you know, it's possible that there's some equality in a conflict. But when it appears that abuse is occurring, we have to look at it as unequal and think about how you can support someone rather than telling them what to do. The third thing is really shifting our attention to, like, why did Ray Rice feel like he could punch his wife? Why do other people who are abusive, you know, why do they feel legitimized? And I think the answer is because they can get away with it.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Kathleen Arnold. She's a professor of political science at DePaul University, and her latest book is called Why Don't You Just Talk to Him? The Politics of Domestic Abuse. We've been talking to her in October, Domestic Abuse Awareness Month.